Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Gordon Edwards, one of Canada's best-known independent experts on nuclear technology, uranium, and weapons proliferation. He's also the co-founder of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, or CCNR. Dr. Edwards was instrumental in bringing about a halt to uranium exploration in Newfoundland and Labrador, Nova Scotia, and British Columbia. He was awarded the 2006 Nuclear Free Future Award in the education category, and in 2009 addressed the annual meeting of Physicians for Global Survival in Ottawa. He's acted as a consultant to many governmental and non-governmental organisations, including the Auditor General of Canada and the Ontario Royal Commission on Electric Power Planning. Dr. Gordon Edwards has been a teacher in the mathematics faculty at Vanier College since 1974, and he joins us now on the line. Hello, Gordon.
Hello, Helen, and welcome to Canada.
Well, yeah, this is being broadcast in some Canadian community stations. There could be more. And also in many stations throughout the States, and quite a lot of stations now in Australia. So it's all relevant to those three countries because...
It certainly is a global issue.
Yeah, because of the uranium connection. So, look, I'd really like to start with Canada's introduction and historic role in the nuclear age, because it's terribly pertinent and something I think most people don't understand or realise. So why don't you go?
Okay, great. Well... I don't think many people realize that the World War II atomic bomb project was really an agreement between three countries to cooperate, and those were Britain, the United States, and Canada. In fact, there was a document signed in Quebec City here in Canada in 1943 by President Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Prime Minister Mackenzie King of Canada, and it's called the Quebec Accord. And this Quebec Accord... pledged all three countries to work together cooperatively to develop the world's first atomic bombs. And it had three provisions. One was not to use the bomb against each other. The second was not to use the bomb against a third party without unanimous consent. And the third was to work together after the war to try and control nuclear power worldwide. So... Canada was in on the ground floor, and the reason we were involved is simply because we had the only readily available supply of uranium that wasn't under German control.
That's interesting. And why 1943? Who instigated this? I mean, I know that Einstein had developed the theory of relativity, and they're already on their way. And I suppose the Manhattan Project had already been set up, had it not, at Los Alamos? In New Mexico?
Well, no, it actually hadn't been. What happened was that originally the discovery about nuclear fission, the fact that you could get enormous amounts of energy by splitting uranium atoms, and by the way, many people may not realize that uranium is the only naturally occurring substance on Earth whereby you can get these large amounts of energy. In other words, you can't build any kind of nuclear weapon without uranium to begin with. And this discovery was made in Berlin around Christmas time in 1938, just at the very threshold of World War II. So the fact that the discovery was made in Berlin, the fact that Czechoslovakia had been occupied by the Germans, and that was the place where Marie Curie got her uranium from, and the fact that heavy water, the only supply of heavy water in the world, was in Norway, all of these things led to the fear that that the Nazis could have everything they needed to develop the world's first atomic bombs. So that was the big concern in Europe. Now, the supply of heavy water from Norway was actually snuck out of Norway by a French diplomat and flown to Paris. Then when the Germans invaded France, that supply of heavy water was moved to Britain. And then when the Luftwaffe started bombing Britain, Britain moved that heavy water supply to Canada in order to keep it away from the Luftwaffe. So that this is how Canada got involved originally, through Britain's involvement, in developing the world's first atomic bombs. Many people may not realize that Britain actually sent a delegation to the United States, and they had to convince the American scientists that an atomic bomb was possible. Mm. They knew it was possible. The Americans didn't at that point.
Well, tell us what I've never known, Gordon, and I have to admit my ignorance, what heavy water is. How is it made, and why is it necessary for atomic bombs?
Well, it turns out that heavy water isn't really necessary for atomic bombs, but it constitutes what's called a moderator. It's to slow down. Let's back up a little bit. Mm. Uranium atoms are very, very unusual in the fact that when they are bombarded with neutrons, they can actually split into two rather large pieces. And it's that splitting process which releases this enormous energy, which is the power of the atomic bomb, and which is also the power underlying nuclear power reactors. So uranium is unique in this sense, is that there's no other substance in nature that can do this. But you have to have these little subatomic particles called neutrons that are the bullets. These are the bullets that split the uranium atoms. And those bullets, it turns out, have to be slowed down if you want to be able to get a reaction going, a chain reaction going, with just natural uranium as it comes out of the ground. And it turns out that heavy water, which is a naturally occurring but rare form of water, is the best substance for slowing down these neutrons. So,
what's heavy water made of? What is heavy water made of, and where do you find it in nature?
If people think about a water molecule, everybody knows that water is H2O, two atoms of hydrogen combined with one atom of oxygen. Mm. Heavy water is simply the very same thing. It's H2O, except the hydrogen atoms are twice as heavy as usual. Normally, a hydrogen atom only has one proton at the center. Heavy hydrogen has one proton and one neutron. And that makes it twice as heavy, and this gives rise to what's called heavy water. And it turns out that ordinary water contains a very small amount of heavy water. In other words, there's so many atoms in the ordinary water supply that are heavier than usual because they have these heavy water molecules. In order to separate them from the ordinary hydrogen, it requires an enormous amount of energy. And that's why Norway, which had a large hydroelectric dam, was able to produce the world's only supply of heavy water at that time.
Oh.
Now, all of this is a bit technical, but the most significant thing about heavy water and any kind of moderation of neutrons is that it is the key to producing a man-made substance that doesn't exist in nature, which everybody's heard of, called plutonium. And plutonium turns out to be a very powerful nuclear explosive, even more powerful than uranium. And that's the material which most of the bombs in the world today are made from, is plutonium. But every atom of plutonium starts off as an atom of uranium. So without uranium, you've got nothing.
Heavy water isn't used in reactors these days. We've got moderators of boron and all sorts of things, but not heavy water. Is that accurate now, Gordon?
Well, the Canadian reactors do, in fact, use heavy water.
Oh.
Our CANDU reactors are based on heavy water, and it's because of that wartime experience that we got into that particular business. There's other reactors for example, in the nuclear weapons complex of the United States at Savannah River. They have a heavy water reactor which produces the plutonium for their atomic bombs. And heavy water turns out to be the best moderator for neutrons. And consequently, reactors that use heavy water produce far more plutonium than other types of reactors.
Oh.
Now, you can use other moderators. The Russians, for example, used a very, very high-quality form of carbon called graphite.
Mm.
That was in the Chernobyl reactor. Now, the Chernobyl reactor, many people don't realize that it was a dual-purpose reactor. Not only did it produce electricity, but it was also designed to produce plutonium for bombs as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they could simultaneously produce electricity and plutonium. And in fact, all reactors do produce simultaneously electricity and plutonium. Now, the graphite moderator is not as efficient as the heavy water moderator, and the result is that you don't get as much plutonium that way. The American reactors use light water, ordinary light water, as a moderator, and they get comparatively less plutonium as well.
Yeah, and they use boron moderating rods. So let's go on in the history. Oh, first of all, was it Lise Meitner in Berlin who discovered fission?
Well, Lise Meitner, being Jewish, she had to leave Berlin. She went to Norway to live with Bohr, Niels Bohr. And she's the one, however, who figured out what was going on when the German scientists split the uranium atom. They didn't know what the heck was happening. And they sent their results to Lise Meitner, who was a very smart woman, a very good scientist. And she's the one who figured out that what they were discovering was, in fact, that the uranium atom had split. They didn't realize the results that they had obtained.
Oh, and it was...
So she's the one who actually realized that the uranium atom had split, and it was Niels Bohr, whom she was working with at the time, who popularized this idea in the West, and the word spread like wildfire throughout the scientific community.
Yeah, and her laboratory assistant got the Nobel Prize for her work. Is that correct?
Yes, and she did not get credit for her work. She did not get even mentioned in the Nobel Prize that was issued to the two researchers who actually did the experiment but could not understand the results.
That's a kind of familiar story to me, but we won't go into that.
That's right.
Yeah, so we had the agreement in Quebec in 1943 with Roosevelt, Churchill and Mackenzie. Now,
Mackenzie King,
your prime minister, and then I've got on your notes a secret laboratory was established in 1943 in Montreal, and there was wartime decision to build the Chalk River reactor in 1944. Can you explain what those are, please, Gordon Edwards?
Well, first of all, Canada's uranium industry boomed not only during the Second World War, but afterwards. Right up until 1965, all of the uranium produced in Canada was used for bombs. So we had a thriving industry here in Canada. In 1959, for example, uranium was the fourth most significant export from Canada after wheat, lumber, and pulp came uranium. And all of that uranium was for bombs. So that the big buildup in nuclear weaponry in the United States was fueled with Canadian uranium. Now, as far as the secret laboratory goes, this laboratory here in Montreal, just a few blocks from where I live, in fact, was a laboratory to investigate the best ways of producing plutonium for bombs. So while we were exporting uranium, we were also investigating ways of producing plutonium. The scientists in the secret laboratory here in Montreal were basically British scientists together with French scientists, and the Canadian scientists were like junior partners. They were the, you might say, on the fast learning track.
It was
at that laboratory that the best methods so far developed for separating plutonium and producing plutonium were developed. This is why, after the war, both Britain and France had such an easy time to develop their own nuclear weapons programs, because they had learned how to do it here in Montreal at this laboratory. And so when they went back to their respective countries at the end of the war, they were able to quickly get on track and develop their own nuclear weapons.
Is there nuclear waste and it's still in that area of Montreal, around the corner from you, Gordon?
They didn't actually produce plutonium at Montreal. What they did was they simply studied the science of it. They used very small quantities, very, very minute quantities, and they figured out in detail all of the chemical and nuclear processes necessary to mass produce the material. So the decision was made in 1944 in Washington, D.C., to build the world's first heavy water reactor here in Canada at Chalk River, Ontario. And it was part of the bomb program. They have a bronze plaque at the Chalk River Visitor Center, which says that the first self-sustaining nuclear reaction in Canada was achieved just 1 month after the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb at Chalk River. And it was originally intended as a way of producing plutonium for bombs. It's very explicit about that. Because the first reactors that were built for one purpose only, and that was to produce plutonium for bombs. Later on, they got the idea that since we're producing plutonium anyway, and since in the process of producing plutonium we generate an awful lot of heat, isn't there some way that we could use the byproduct heat to generate, for example, electricity? So the idea of generating electricity was an afterthought.
Yeah. And also, I think it was, as I knew quite a lot of the characters who were in the Manhattan Project making the bombs, they felt such guilt about vaporizing and annihilating nearly or more than 200,000 people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they talked to me about this, that, if they could harness the atoms for so-called peaceful purposes, they might go to their graves feeling less guilty, but I don't think they actually did when they all died. So then you've got in your list of things to be discussed, excellent list. Gordon Edwards, why don't you now give us your website, because I think it's the most informative website I've ever seen on all things nuclear. So what is it?
Well, thank you very much. It's www.ccnr. That stands for Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. So it's ccnr.org.
Good. Please, everyone, make use of that. Now, you've got the role in nuclear weapons programs of the US and UK, France, Russia, Israel, India, and Pakistan. I guess you're talking about Canada's role in those nuclear weapons programs.
Well, that's right. Canada played a small but significant role in spreading the bomb around the world. First of all, even during the war, we didn't play very much of a role directly other than supplying uranium. But after the war, when we had our own nuclear reactors running at Chalk River, we sold a lot of our plutonium to the United States for military purposes, for bombs.
Really?
Yes. We also sold plutonium. We didn't even sell it. I think we gave it to the British. And in fact, the bomb that was first exploded by the British in off Australia and the Montebello Islands, that bomb probably used some Canadian plutonium, because the very first plutonium metal that the British ever got was from Chalk River, Canada. And it was actually British scientists who were working at Chalk River. These were not mostly Canadian scientists. The Canadian scientists were more or less like apprentices. And it was the British scientists who were really running the show. And they used Chalk River. They at Chalk River, they produced plutonium, and they built a very small plutonium reprocessing plant at Chalk River. And there they separated plutonium and sent it to Britain. So Britain got its first sample of plutonium from there, and it was probably incorporated into the first bomb. Now, also, there were a couple of people who were Russian spies. We call them Russian spies. At the time, you know, there was a tradition in the scientific community that you share results worldwide.
Yeah.
And that you don't hold secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who believed that it was not proper for anybody to monopolize this technology. And whether for mercenary or for ideological reasons, they sent information to Russia and to other countries. And from Chalk River, actually, Joseph Stalin's regime got their very first tiny sample of plutonium that came straight from Chalk River through one of these spies. And the existence of a spy network in Canada was revealed just a couple of months after the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb, and there was a big investigation here in Canada and a big expose of all of the spying that had been going on. So we contributed indirectly to the Russian nuclear program as well as the French and the British nuclear programs, as well as the American nuclear program. And it was France, it turns out, it was France who helped Israel to build the Dimona reactor in Israel. And reports have indicated that that Dimona reactor bears an uncanny resemblance to the Canadian reactor at Chalk River, which the French helped to design when they were here in Montreal.
Oh.
So the French already had the plans for a very powerful neutron-generating reactor that could produce a lot of plutonium in a short time. And they used that to help themselves and also to help Israel. So, you know, Canada, not very long afterwards, we gave a copy of that very same reactor, the very same reactor that I just mentioned, the NRX reactor it was called. We gave a copy of this free of charge to India as a gift.
Really?
Thinking that this would, well, the idea was that nuclear power was going to be the savior of mankind. Nuclear power was going to be a clean, inexhaustible, safe, abundant, eternal source of energy, and it would lift the entire planet out of poverty. And so Canada was being very magnanimous by giving a copy of their first reactor to India. And then they acted very shocked when India used that reactor to do exactly what we did in Canada, which is to produce plutonium and use it for bombs. Now, we didn't use it for bombs ourselves. We sold it to the Americans. But the Indians took that plutonium and they used it to make their first atomic bomb, which was exploded in 1974.
But I thought they used a CANDU reactor for that. Is that incorrect? A Canadian?
That's not strictly speaking correct, because their first reactor was not at all an electricity-producing reactor. It was what's called an experimental reactor. It was a precursor of the CANDU. It was a heavy water reactor, but it wasn't really a CANDU because it didn't produce electricity. It only produced plutonium and other isotopes.
For bombs. I'm interviewing today Dr. Gordon Edwards, one of Canada's best-known independent experts on nuclear technology, uranium, and weapons proliferation. He's the co-founder of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Now, what is Canada's relationship indirectly with Pakistan, Gordon?
Well, once again, Pakistan was one of our early customers. We sold a reactor to Pakistan on very favorable terms. We loaned them the money and charged them virtually no interest to build their first nuclear reactor. And at that time, both France and Germany, this is back in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, both France and Germany at that time were very eager to sell countries reprocessing equipment. Reprocessing equipment basically is the equipment you need to separate the plutonium from the waste. So when the uranium fuel goes into the reactor, here's what happens. Inside the reactor, this uranium fuel, there's two things that go on. One is that the uranium atoms are being split and enormous energy is being released. That energy is used to boil water, and the steam is used to turn a turbine and generate electricity. So basically, from that point of view, a nuclear reactor is just a fancy way to boil water. However, while this is going on, the broken pieces of uranium atoms accumulate in the core of the reactor, and they turn out to be millions of times more radioactive than the uranium itself. So it's all these broken pieces of uranium atoms that constitute the bulk of what they call high-level radioactive waste, which we don't know how to destroy or neutralize. We have to find some place to store it safely for the next 10 million years. And, of course, this is a terrible problem associated with nuclear power, these terrible nuclear waste, which nobody has found a permanent solution for, and it's not on the horizon. But at the same time that that's going on, there's also a transmutation process happening. Some of those uranium atoms do not split. They absorb neutrons and become heavier, and they're the ones who turn into plutonium.
Yeah.
So plutonium is being created. They use the word breeding. You're breeding plutonium right inside the reactor. That plutonium remains dangerous in terms of weapons use for tens and hundreds of thousands of years into the future, because the half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years. It means that after 24,000 years, there's going to be half as much left, but that's still enough to make hundreds and thousands of nuclear bombs. So from that point of view, you could say that a nuclear reactor is not really producing electricity so much as it is producing two things: long-lived nuclear waste, which lasts for millions of years, and plutonium, which lasts for many thousands of years. The electricity is just a little drop in the bucket. It's just a flash in the pan. Mm-hmm. You get electricity maybe for 20 or 30 years if you're lucky, and then you have plutonium forever.
Byproduct. That's why I don't understand, Gordon Edwards, how it is that Obama, but everyone else too, doesn't understand what you've just said, that the plutonium lasts virtually forever. So any country that has a reactor can now or in the future, and you never know what the government's going to be next time. Dictatorships come and go, mad people come and go. Any country that has a reactor for the rest of time theoretically can make themselves nuclear weapons. I don't understand why the scientists and the politicians, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me, why they don't get that.
Well, they do understand that basic fact, but they're fooled by the... There's a certain degree of, you might call it blind faith, coupled with hypocrisy. The blind faith is a faith that science can solve all problems. And we know, I'm a mathematician by training, and we mathematicians know that this is not true. There are problems which have been, mathematical problems, which have been posed thousands of years ago by the ancient Greeks, which have not only not been solved, but which have been proven to be unsolvable. In other words, there never will be a solution to these particular problems, because they are simply unsolvable. Now, science doesn't have that that self-awareness to realize that they may be able to create problems that cannot be solved. And I think nuclear weapons is one of those problems. So the only way to reduce the risk of nuclear destruction to zero is to eliminate all the nuclear weapons and to eliminate the basis of these nuclear weapons, which is the uranium traffic. Because as long as you have a traffic in uranium, as long as you have reprocessing of fuel, nuclear reactors producing plutonium, and enrichment plants, which are enriching the uranium so that they can be used for bombs, as long as you have that technology in place, you're never going to get rid of nuclear weapons.
But even if you stop exporting uranium, how many hundreds of thousands of tons of plutonium have we already produced, either in unreprocessed radioactive fuel, Japan's got, I don't know, 200 tons of plutonium that's stockpiled? I mean, some extraordinary figure. So
yes, and India also has a lot of separated plutonium.
So, yeah.
Well, we've dug ourselves into a deep hole here. But on the other hand, there is an optimistic trend to this. The optimistic thread is that more and more leaders around the world, people who at one time were even enthusiastic about nuclear weapons, are coming out more and more and saying that we have to have a world without nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
We have to have zero nuclear weapons. We have to eliminate them entirely.
Yeah.
Now, Obama is the very first president, U.S. president, who has ever stated that publicly, that our goal should be zero nuclear weapons. Now, those are only words. There's an awful lot of work that has to be done behind it. But there's a lot of momentum in the world today. For example, there's an organization started by the mayor of Hiroshima, which now has almost 5,000 members, called Mayors for Peace. And the message that they're sending to their own governments around the world and to the United Nations is that we cities, the millions of men, women, and children living in these cities, we are the targets of these nuclear weapons. And we have an obligation to protect our citizens, and we cannot protect our citizens unless we eliminate all these nuclear weapons and the nuclear traffic that goes with it. Now, I don't think this is an impossible task. I think it's very difficult, but it's not impossible. In fact, what is impossible is to keep on going as we're going. That's what's impossible. Now, as far as the weapons materials like plutonium is concerned, you're absolutely right. We can't wish the plutonium out of existence. But what we can do is, as our Prime Minister Trudeau said at the United Nations way back in 1978, he said, in order to achieve a nuclear weapons-free world, you have to first of all adopt a strategy of suffocation by choking off the vital oxygen upon which the arms race feeds. And this vital oxygen is the supply of what is called fissile materials. Now, it turns out there's only two types of materials which can be used to make atomic bombs, and those are highly enriched uranium and plutonium. So the first place to begin is to have an international ban, worldwide ban, on enrichment plants of all kinds and plutonium reprocessing plants of all kinds. So once you ban those two technologies, then what you have done is you've made it impossible to produce more of this weapons-usable material. The next thing you have to do is you have to gather together all of the nuclear weapons material which has been produced and make it unusable for nuclear weapons. Mm. And you can do this with the uranium by mixing the existing highly enriched uranium with the so-called depleted uranium. By the time you mix them together, you can't make a bomb with it anymore without an enrichment plant.
Mm.
Similarly, with the plutonium, we have all these, unfortunately, we have all these reservoirs, tanks of high-level radioactive liquid waste, which is from nuclear reactors. If we mix the plutonium back with those highly radioactive constituents from which they were originally separated and then re-solidify the mass into a very highly radioactive glass formation, then you can't make bombs with it anymore. The only way you could make a bomb from it would be to re-separate the plutonium, and that would require a reprocessing plant.
Yeah, but Gordon...
So Trudeau's idea is to ban the plants that make these things and then try and make sure that the existing material can't be used for bombs.
Okay, so I knew Trudeau. In fact, I had lunch with him, with Margot Kidder, and
right.
I convinced him to do the Five Continent Six Nation Peace Initiative. But on the other hand, he knew...
Right.
that Canada, all the way along, and at that time, was still one of the major exporters of uranium. Why the hell didn't he stop it?
Well, that's a good. That's the problem with politics. Is that you know, if you yourself, Dr. Caldicott, or I were suddenly to find ourselves as the head of our country, we'd find that we're not just autocrats. We can't just dictate that something's going to happen. You have to. You have a cabinet to deal with. You have all these pressures, these political pressures, all these huge companies, these huge corporations, which wield inordinate influence. So making these decisions is not an easy thing to do. It's one of the reasons why I believe that it's so important to have leadership from the grassroots.
Yeah.
My belief is, and this is my serious belief, is that all issues of global importance show leadership not from the top down, but from the bottom up. Whether it comes to human rights or feminism or anti-war or anti-nuclear, environmental movement, you name it, any of the movements that have global importance, the leaders are the last to know. Because the grassroots, they're the ones who have to provide the leadership.
Yeah, well, we did that.
And I think that even if you had a leader who was intellectually convinced that this is the way to go, he needs to have an aroused citizenry.
She, Gordon.
She needs to have an aroused citizenry so that she can say, look,
yeah.
I've got to do what the people want, and this is what the people want.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think that an inspired leader...
can make a big difference.
Oh, well, yeah, because I kind of helped to lead the movement in America in the 80s against nuclear weapons. You can inspire the masses, you know. So if I was the Prime Minister of Australia, I wish I was, but I would... use the media appropriately to educate people about the extraordinary medical dangers of mining, selling uranium, fissioning it, and the production of weapons. And within a short time, because I've done it three times before in my life in various countries, you can convince the masses that this is not a good idea, and they rise up spontaneously. So I know that a leader is subject to extraordinary stress and pressure, but I guess I believe in benevolent dictatorship as long as I'm the dictator.
Right.
But leaders can do a lot, and that's why I think people have been disappointed with Obama, because although he promised a lot, he's now been co-opted, clearly, by the military-industrial nuclear complex, and they're so powerful, those blokes. And you need extraordinary willpower and personality, like, I suppose, Roosevelt or Churchill, although Churchill was a big wartime prime minister. He loved war.
Of course he was,
yeah. But someone like Roosevelt to lead the people, or even Rabin in Israel before he was assassinated, I think he had that kind of leadership too. Few do. I think Gorbachev did, but he was quickly eliminated by Yeltsin, etc. So anyway, let's move on, Dr. Gordon
sure,
Edwards. I'd like to discuss Port Hope. Now, Port Hope is a little town, a lovely, pretty little town in Ontario, Canada, on Lake Ontario. And in the early 30s, the Labine brothers, I think, decided to take pitch blende from, I think, Saskatchewan, which is a uranium-type substance, and refine radium from pitch blende to be used in wartime instruments, because radium is luminescent in the dark, but radium is incredibly carcinogenic, as we know. People who painted watch dials with radium-enriched paint used to lick the paintbrushes so they'd be pointy, make the figures accurate. And many of those women, in fact, almost the majority, died of aplastic anemia, leukemia, and bone cancer. So we knew right back then it was dangerous. So they refined the radium, and then that plant was converted by the Canadian government to refine uranium for the bombs. And it refined uranium for American weapons until 57. What I don't understand, Dr. Edwards, is why did it stop then, when you've just said that until 1965, in fact, Canada provided the uranium for all the US nuclear weapons. Why did Port Hope not continue until 65 and close down in 57?
Port Hope has been continually operating from the time it first began,
yeah.
And it's still operating very much today.
Yeah.
In 1965, there was a shift there were two things that happened. Around 1960, the military contracts dried up because the Americans already had a surplus of uranium. They didn't need any more uranium for their bomb program.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they learned how to make bombs without buying uranium. The way they did this was by using the uranium leftovers, which have no commercial value, called depleted uranium. And they took this depleted uranium that was produced by the civilian program, and they didn't have to pay for it or buy it. They simply took it and used it to make the plutonium for their bombs. So they stopped buying uranium around 1960, and about 5 years later, the contracts had to be fulfilled that were already signed, so there was still production going on. But about 5 years later, Canada announced that henceforth they would no longer sell uranium for military purposes. And that was under Prime Minister Pearson, who won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
And so that was when Canada first announced that they would no longer sell uranium for military purposes. They would only sell it for peaceful purposes. And that's been the policy ever since. But there has been a shell game going on, and that is that the military continued to produce plutonium for bombs by simply using the leftover depleted uranium and using that as the raw material to produce the plutonium that they needed.
Yeah, but that depleted uranium is partly produced at Port Hope, or the uranium hexafluoride is produced at Port Hope, then sent to Paducah, Kentucky, where it's enriched, and so you get uranium-235 for use in nuclear power plants. And the uranium-238, which is the depleted stuff, remains. And I also, from my reading, see that Port Hope was involved in making depleted uranium weapons for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Bosnia and the like. Do you know that to be true, Dr. Edwards?
No, I don't. I don't know the details of that. And Port Hope, I believe, does process depleted uranium. Let me explain where the depleted uranium comes from.
Yeah.
In nature, the uranium that you get out of the ground is a mixture of two significant types. There's really three types, but the two significant ones are uranium-238, as you mentioned, and uranium-235. Turns out that the uranium-235 is the explosive kind.
Mm.
That's the kind that you can make bombs from. You can't make bombs from uranium-238 directly.
Mm.
So when you take the uranium out of the ground, there's only a very small percentage, which is uranium-235. It's only 7 atoms out of 1,000 that are uranium-235. So the idea of enrichment is to strip away the uranium-238 atoms so that you have concentrated uranium-235. That's what's called highly enriched uranium. And in the process of producing this highly enriched uranium, you discard most of the uranium-238, which is called depleted uranium. So the depleted uranium is the cast-off of the enrichment process. Now, Canada has never had an enrichment industry. We do not enrich uranium, nor does Australia, nor do most of the uranium-producing countries. It's only those that have nuclear weapons or that have some kind of an agreement to be allowed to run a uranium enrichment plant that have this capability. Now, you can also enrich uranium just a little bit in order to make fuel for nuclear reactors, not so high that it becomes bomb material, but high enough that it can give you an extra kick, an extra energy to make these nuclear reactors run faster and more efficiently. You still get a lot of this depleted uranium, the U-238. Turns out that that uranium-238 is the material which produces plutonium-239. Once a uranium-238 atom absorbs a neutron, it becomes plutonium-239. And that's what they do in their military reactors. They convert the U-238 into plutonium-239. They can use it for bombs.
How do they do that? What's the process? Where do they get the neutrons from?
Well, what they do is they use fairly small amounts, relatively small amounts of highly enriched uranium as the fuel rods in these military reactors.
Oh.
So they have fuel rods which are made of highly enriched uranium, which are giving off powerful neutrons. You know, because the uranium-235 is so energetic, the neutrons that are given off are very powerful. And around the outside of these fuel rods, they have hollow cylinders of uranium-238. And these are called target elements. And these target elements, which are made up of material which is of no commercial value whatsoever, these target elements are where the neutrons hit the uranium-238 atoms and change them into plutonium-239 atoms. Then when they just pull these tubes out of the reactor, these metallic tubes, they can dissolve them in acid and separate out the plutonium that has been created.
So that's a breeder.
No, this is not a breeder. This is a plutonium production reactor, it's called. It's not a breeder, but breeders are much larger machines which produce electricity, and they would be much, much larger, and they would produce plutonium on a continual basis.
Yeah, right.
But in a way, you could call it a kind of a mini breeder because
mini
it
breeder.
Does breed plutonium.
Yeah, I'm interviewing Dr. Gordon Edwards, who in fact is a mathematician, but he's a wonderful expert in nuclear technology in Canada, as you can very well hear. We're a little bit off the track.
Let's get back to nuclear power and in the role of energy supply. You see, a lot of people are being fooled into thinking because of the publicity and the public relations that's going on. They have been tricked into thinking that nuclear power offers a solution to the climate change problem. That somehow, if we build a lot of nuclear reactors, we're going to eliminate the carbon dioxide emissions, and therefore the greenhouse gas problem is going to go away, and we're going to have a sustainable planet by building a lot of reactors. This is absolutely untrue, and everybody who is knowledgeable, whether they're in the nuclear industry or out of the nuclear industry, knows that it is impossible for nuclear power to solve the climate change problem. It can make, at best, a moderate contribution. For example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change back in a couple of years ago published a report in which they said that with luck, nuclear power could expand its present contribution, which of 16% of the world's electricity, they could expand this over a period of 25 years to be 18% of the world's electricity. Well, you know, this is not solving the problem. It's making a contribution, but it's not solving the problem. And as long as people are fooled into thinking that nuclear power is somehow a magic solution, they're going to be very, very sorry, because they're going to invest billions of dollars, create horrendous problems for the planet, and they're not going to solve the greenhouse problem. So we're trying to counteract this false information and pointing out that that in fact, the best way to go is to stop building nuclear reactors, to shut them down, phase them out, and divert the money that's now going into nuclear into truly sustainable resources, which are solar, wind, geothermal, and so on. These are the resources, and most importantly of all, energy efficiency investments. These are the things which are really going to put us on the path towards sustainability.
But then, Dr. Edwards, your country is incredibly pro-nuclear and participating in exporting fuel rods via Port Hope and other to countries all over the world for nuclear reactors. I mean, how are you going to, you know, close the industry down in Canada? People say, they'll lose their jobs. Well, what about creating jobs with solar power plants and windmills and geothermal? Yeah. I mean, it's all crazy, isn't it?
Well, there's been a lot of study done on this, and it's quite clear that investments in renewable energy and energy conservation produce far more jobs than the same amount of money invested in nuclear or uranium mining. Now, here in Canada, it's quite true to say that we are one of the world's largest exporters of uranium and always have been. But that happened under a veil of secrecy. Wartime secrecy really prevailed up until about 1965. And the only province of Canada which is currently massively involved in uranium mining is the province of Saskatchewan, which started quite early, as you mentioned earlier in the talk. Now, other provinces of Canada have been debating the issue of whether they should get into uranium mining. And so far, we have British Columbia, which is a very large province, which has permanently banned uranium mining from ever taking place in that province. We have Nova Scotia, which has passed a law making it illegal for anybody to mine uranium. As a matter of fact, if they encounter uranium accidentally when they're mining something else, they have to stop. They can't continue. Also, in Labrador, as you mentioned, the Inuit government there has passed a temporary moratorium on uranium mining, which could become permanent. We've heard word just recently from two ministers of the New Brunswick government, which is another province, that they will be imposing a permanent ban on uranium mining in that province before the end of the year. And we're working here in Quebec to try and get a permanent ban on uranium mining in Quebec. So we're working on it. We're trying to put the genie back in the bottle, and it's always tougher once it's out of the bottle, of course. It's so much harder to put it back in.
Yeah.
But we are making real progress in Canada, and we need the help of the rest of the world because, you know, we all have to work together on this. This is not just a Canadian problem. It's a worldwide problem. And the more help that we get from other countries, the easier it is for us to shut down the industry here.
Well, you're doing wonderful work, Gordon, and I know that you're one of the leaders in preventing uranium mining all over Canada. I'd like to just come back to Port Hope for a second. I was there recently and got myself into hot water by saying that the town should be evacuated because, in fact, much of it has been built on and with uranium tailings or waste from radium production and uranium production. But what towers over that town, like a sort of mythic castle in a way, is the Cameco plant, which continuously extrudes uranium from its stacks and from cracks in the walls, etc., over the town and into the water of Lake Ontario, while making huge amounts of uranium for reactors all over the world. It seems to me that Cameco, which has also funded parts of the hospital in Saskatchewan, should itself be closed down. I mean, I'd like to attack Cameco full frontal. Is that appropriate? Can it be done? You know, they're sort of the nidus of the problem in a way in Canada. They're the biggest uranium producer in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's always complicated when you have a town that prides itself on having being a nice place to live in, and other than the radioactive contamination, which is very extensive and very pervasive, and they have a $260 million cleanup program earmarked by the federal government just to try and consolidate the 800,000 tons of radioactive waste, which has been dumped into the harbor and dumped into ravines around town. Despite that, nevertheless, if you know, the thing about radiation is you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. It's invisible to our five senses. And unfortunately, with us human beings, out of sight, out of mind. I'm reminded of when I was a kid, my mother and father were both pharmacists, and they both smoked heavily. Doctors smoked cigarettes. Movie stars smoked cigarettes. And people thought it was glamorous. And the reason people were fooled into thinking it was okay is that they didn't notice anybody falling over dead after smoking a cigarette. And it's the same thing with radiation. You don't see people falling down dead on the street because of radiation. What happens is it's very insidious. It's very long-term. It gets into the body and oftentimes have a latency period of 20, 30, 40 years before you really see what the British Columbia Medical Association has called a gradually flowering crop of radiation-induced cancers.
Yeah, yes. And there's never been an adequate scientific peer-reviewed epidemiological study done of the people in Port Hope, even though they've been exposed to radiation for 80 years. It reminds me, Dr. Edwards, of a patient having to tell them that they've got some sort of awful disease like pancreatic cancer and or their child has cystic fibrosis. And the first reaction, apart from shock, is anger. And the anger is usually directed towards the doctor. And then they pass through the angry phase once they've accepted the diagnosis into depression. And I think probably the anger is partly an innate sense of grief that what the doctors are saying is correct about the people of Port Hope. And I just have to say, I think the Canadian government and Cameco have been really wicked in not telling the people the truth and saying low-level radiation is in fact safe and there's no problem and that town is as healthy as any other town. As a physician, it just actually takes my breath away because you know how hard we struggle, Gordon, in trying to save a patient with cancer or a child. And if that child dies in awful distress without its hair and a swollen belly and bleeding to death, you know, the parents never recover. So what we're talking about as physicians is the sanctity of even one human life. And that's what's being glossed over by this industry and by the Canadian government, I feel.
Well, it's not just being glossed over. It's being really misrepresented.
Yeah.
You said, for example, quite correctly, that there haven't been any really good studies done, no good epidemiological studies. But that's not to say there haven't been any studies. There were some studies.
Mm.
And what really makes me angry as a mathematician, as a scientist, as a human being, is that these studies that they have done do show increases beyond the expected amount in things like brain cancer, childhood leukemia, and other various diseases. But because of the mathematical calculations they do, they say it is not significant. Now, this idea of not being significant is simply based on the fact that you don't have a very good study.
Mm.
If you design a better study, then you can get what are called statistically significant results.
Yeah.
So what they do is they consistently interpret the increases of leukemia and brain cancer and other things that they do as being due only to chance. And in fact, they are misusing mathematics, they're misusing science, and they're misusing people's trust.
Yes, and that's let alone the genetic abnormalities that will accrue over generations from having the eggs and sperm irradiated by background gamma radiation, and that's never mentioned either. Anyway,
no, and that's also something which they, it's very difficult because radiation has such far-reaching effects. You know, radiation is the only carcinogenic agent which causes all kinds of human cancers that we know of.
Mm.
Radiation can cause not only increases in lung cancer, blood cancers, leukemia, pancreatic cancer, stomach cancer, liver cancer. There's not a single type of human cancer that cannot be increased by radiation exposure.
Mm.
So the result is that when you design these studies, oftentimes you don't even know for sure what you're looking for. Now, up until fairly recently, I myself was ignorant of the fact, I only found this out a couple of years ago, that when they emit the uranium dust into the air that goes through these very high-efficiency filters called HEPA filters, what happens is that some of the dust that goes through is what's called submicron particles. They're aerosol particles. They're like cigarette smoke. And it turns out that this is the most dangerous kind of radioactive material because it goes deeper down into the lungs. It's not stopped by the cilia and by the various mechanisms the lung has of clearing foreign particles.
Mm.
It goes right down into the deepest parts of the lungs. But what I didn't know until recently is that it passes through into the blood and goes directly to the brain. And so these aerosol-type particles go directly to the brain, which, of course, for me, suddenly a light went on, and I realized that's why they have the increase in brain cancer.
Oh.
I hadn't realized this mechanism. But, you see, the people that are in the nuclear industry in Canada are generally not medically trained people.
Mm.
They are physicists. They are engineers. They are... they're dealing with what they do is they measure levels of radioactivity, but they do not examine human health.
Yeah.
They do not. Now, medical people such as yourself, Dr. Caldicott, work the other way around. You look for the medical effects, and then you work backwards towards the cause.
Mm. Well, you know, the dictum in medicine says, first of all, you can only cure a disease if you find the cause. And if a disease
right.
is incurable, then you work to prevent it, which is actually what this is. The discussion today has all been about. We've run out of time, Dr. Edwards. I thank you so much for this fascinating discussion. I'm sure everyone listening will be stimulated to go to your website, which is
www.ccnr.org.
www.ccnr.org. And thank you once again, and it might be interesting to have you back in another year to discuss progress in Canada.
Well, I would like to thank you, Dr. Caldicott, for all you've done over the years, because you came here. I saw you in Montreal many years ago, about 1 year before the film was made, If You Love This Planet.
Hmm.
And you have been an inspiration to countless numbers of people. And I really want to thank you for your hard work over all those years.
Oh, thank you.
Ongoing, of course.
Yeah, that's very kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity. Bye-bye.
On If You Love This Planet today, I've been speaking with Dr. Gordon Edwards, one of Canada's best-known independent experts on nuclear technology, uranium, and weapons proliferation. Apart from being a mathematician, he's also the co-founder of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility at www.ccnr.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.